from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, you know what the big topics of the week were. It makes me look forward, however, because I cannot wait to see what Mayor Ray Nagin of New Orleans says come St. Patrick's Day. God wants this to be a potato city. But there is a verbal formulation that's gaining favor among the defenders of the administration, especially in the wake of the tape that came out this week, the audio tape from the last man using audio cassettes on the planet, Osama bin Laden. And Dick Cheney, among others, said in reaction to that, vis-a-vis that, thank you so much, we have been safe from attack inside the United States for 4 years. It is no accident. He's saying, you know, the point being, what a good job we're doing. We point with pride, Department, that obviously if there's been no attack inside the United States for 4 years, somebody in Washington, D.C. is doing one heck of a job. One fine job. And, you know, there's a surface logic to that, which leads you directly to the further point that after the World Trade Center was attacked in 1993, there was no attack in the United States for 8 years. So somebody in Washington must have been doing twice as good a job back then. Hello, welcome to the show.
As I walk through this wicked world, madness of insanity. I ask myself, is all hope lost? Is there only pain, hatred, and misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I want to know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? And as I walk on through troubled times, my spirit gets so downhearted sometimes. So where are the strong? Who are the trusted? Where is the harmony, sweet harmony? Cause each time I feel it slipping away, it makes me wanna cry. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? I walk through this broken world, searching for life in the darkness of insanity. I ask myself, is our home lost? Is the only pain, hatred, misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I want to know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? So funny about peace, love, and understanding. Cause every time I feel like this inside, one thing I wanna know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Well now, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Cause each time I feel it slipping away, it makes me wanna cry. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so good about peace, love, and understanding?
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless. Wait just a moment. We've had now, I'm Harry Scherer. Welcome you to the show. We've had now 2 weeks of news that calls into question the iconic phrase, home of the homeless. Got to put our thinking caps on now. Dateline Santa Monica. Santa Monica is number 9 on a new list of the 20 meanest cities in the United States when it comes to passing laws against the homeless. And it's a distinction that has local city council members miffed. The National Coalition for the Homeless and the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, a Washington, D.C.-based group that tracks the, quote, criminalization, unquote, of homelessness nationwide, based the ranking on the number of municipal laws aimed at homeless individuals, their enforcement, the city's history of criminalizing homelessness, and other criteria. Says Michael Stoops, yes, spelled the way it sounds, acting executive director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. Quote, we don't like to say that a city is mean, and we don't want to say that the city as a whole is a bad or uncaring place. We're only trying to draw attention to the fact that these cities are criminalizing the behavior of people who are homeless. Homeless people need our help, not more laws that hurt them, unquote. Santa Monica officials say the report unfairly characterizes how the city handles homelessness, highlighting laws they say are on the books to assure quality of life. Can't we all have quality of life, whether we're homeless or not? Health and safety, while completely omitting steps taken to assist homeless individuals. They point out that Santa Monica currently spends $1.7 million to help combat, I guess that's a year, doesn't say here, to combat homelessness. half of that amount coming directly from city coffers. What about the people who don't cough? Hey, just glad to be here. Ladies and gentlemen, maybe we're not the home of the homeless after all, here where this broadcast originates. Some news about Katrina and its aftermath. And please, if you're not already doing so, go check the Eat the Press section at www.huffingtonpost.com, because there's some wonderful stuff that wonderful stuff that happens to be there that flows through me that will keep you more up to date about what's going on down yonder than you otherwise might be, including the fact that on Anderson Cooper 360 Friday night, the mayor of New Orleans, Ray Chocolate City Nagin, said there'd never been a mandatory evacuation in New Orleans before. And Anderson just kind of nodded. And I thought to myself, well, then what was that that I was in 1999 for Hurricane George, proclaimed by then-Mayor Mark Morial? But see, Anderson doesn't need to know stuff because he cares too much to know. Anyway, Dateline Washington, a bill for busing evacuees from New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina was $32 million more than it should have been. The government paid it without question. Well, what good would questions do if you're going to pay it? You know what I'm saying? At least just pay the money. Landstar Express America. Yeah, that's how I ride when I'm in a hurricane. Was given 570 specific tasks to supply enough vehicles to haul thousands of truckloads of goods and thousands of busloads of people after the hurricane struck. The Transportation Department's Inspector General's office reviewed six of the tasks paid for by the FAA, which for some reason was the agency writing the checks. The example of bus service to New Orleans, quote, underscores the need to ensure that all pending invoices are accompanied by some type of documentation that substantiates that the goods and services were provided as billed, unquote, according to the report. I mean, they're not doing that? It's a good point, though. Make sure you got what you paid for. Always a good point. The report said the FAA overpaid Landstar for two of those six tasks. For one, the agency paid a 59. This can't be right. A $59 million partial payment with no documentation showing the actual amount of services provided to that date. Okay. Just ask for some proof that you got it, okay? Meanwhile, a study this week by the New Orleans Times-Picayune newspaper found 44 of 435 members of the House of Representatives, 10%, have actually gone to New Orleans to see the devastation. That's a far cry from the percentage that visited New York after 9/11, according to U.S. Congressman Charlie Melanson of Louisiana, hence the name. Quote, when 9/11 happened, you had to beat members of Congress off with a stick from going to New York City, he said. New Orleans, he pointed out, is a, quote, major city we need to save, unquote. Melanson said he and other members of the Louisiana delegation plan to send a letter urging Denny Hastert to encourage more members to visit the region. Quote, let them smell the stench. Let them see the inside of homes. It shows them these people just can't come back tomorrow, says Melanson. 30 senators have visited New Orleans. That's almost a third of the Senate, thanks to the efforts by Louisiana Senate delegation. But those congressmen would rather go to New York. I wonder why. Closer? New York was still wide open? Congressmen don't like to drink? Sorry. Here is a story you may have missed. A former Defense Department analyst was sentenced this week to more than 12 years in prison for passing U.S. government secrets to two employees of a pro-Israel lobbying group and to an Israeli government official in Washington. You know this story? Larry Franklin passing intelligence about Iran. Well, that's topical. U.S. District Judge T.S. Ellis III said Franklin didn't intend to harm the United States when he gave the classified data to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, one of Washington's most influential lobbying organizations. When he pleaded guilty, Franklin, an Iran specialist, said he was frustrated with the direction of U.S. policy. Really? About Iran? I wonder why that would be. and thought he could influence it through, quote, back channels, unquote, or broke back channels. Sorry. I believe I accept your explanation that you didn't. All right, anyway. The judge said as he sentenced Franklin to 151 months in prison, your behavior, it doesn't matter that you think you were really helping, that arrogates to yourself the decision whether to adhere to a statute passed by Congress, and we can't have that in this country, unquote. Unless, of course, you're the President of the United States. In which case, have at it, babe. The justification for the Iraq War that has been most recently advanced has to do with what a bad guy Saddam Hussein was. Just a jerk. Just a murderous jerk. Yeah, he threatened his neighbors, but he killed his own people, ladies and gentlemen. Couldn't let that happen. Dateline United Nations. Sorry for mentioning the world body, but here we go. Indonesian security forces and militias that they supported killed at least 100,000 East Timorese people and as many as 180,000 over 24 years through torture, starvation, arbitrary execution, and massacres, according to a report presented to the United Nations by the new president of East Timor, Zanana Gusmao. The 2005-page report provides the most detailed account to date of Indonesia's brutal 24-year occupation. Oh, it was a neighboring country. Interesting. Of the island nation, a former Portuguese colony. It also charged that army's armed resistance movement with committing, quote, serious human rights violations after Indonesia's 1975 invasion of East Timor, including the torture and execution of pro-Indonesian prisoners, the convening of mock trials, and the violent purging, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, Indonesia is a friend of ours. Gusmão said that East Timor's hard-fought independence from Indonesia in 2002 would have to stand as the country's chief symbol of justice for the families of victims. We have consciously rejected the notion of pushing for an international tribunal because, A, it is not practical, B, it would wreck our relationship with Indonesia, which sounds a lot like A, and C, we are serious about supporting Indonesia's own transition towards democracy. So A, B, and C really all sound like A. East Timor's foreign minister told a small group of reporters in New York, in today's Indonesia, or in the foreseeable future, there will be no leader strong enough who could bring to court and prison senior military officers who were involved in violence in the past. They are still too powerful. Unquote. No, that's all. That's it. That's just all. That's it. That's it. That's all. But now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. News you might not otherwise have heard or seen. How about missile defense? Dateline Tucson, Arizona, but not heard on this station. Maybe. I don't know. I don't listen to this station. Whatever station this is. No, I do. I listen to them all. The Pentagon's testing office has less confidence today than it did a year ago in the nation's fledgling missile defense system. A new report from the office says testing of the rudimentary system in place in Alaska and California suggests, but doesn't demonstrate, that it, quote, may have some inherent defensive capability, unquote, to intercept North Korean missiles. Last year's report was less tentative, saying the system, quote, should have some limited capability, unquote. From a limited capability to may have some inherent capability means it's an on-paper capability, says Stephen Hildreth, missile defense analyst for the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service. That's what inherent means, he says, but in terms of real-world data, we don't have it. With time and money, they will get it, but the only question is, will it take a year, or two, or 50? There have been no intercept tests for almost a year after two failures when interceptor missiles never left their silos because of faulty computer software. Hey, that happens to anybody. The new report by David Duma the acting director of operational test and evaluation, praised the U.S. Missile Defense Agency for a prudent plan to thoroughly test all missile components before testing resumes. No resumption date has been set. There is insufficient evidence, Duma wrote in his report, to support a confident assessment that the system provides limited defenses. Even as there is developmental test data that suggests the system may have some inherent defensive capability. Hey, I'm buying into that. Congress has approved spending $37 billion on research in the program through September of this year. Just imagine how much they'd be spending with better reports. You know? I guess we should be grateful. Only $37 billion for an inherent possibility that it might one day be able to... The Missile Defense Agency says the system continues to undergo an extensive shakedown of all components prior to attaining full-time operational status. The shakedown includes training of silo, radar, and command center crews, as well as continually improving the reliability of each component. Flight testing has been delayed while corrective measures are implemented, Duma wrote. The missile agency will, quote, restore confidence in the system through a series of basic and progressively more challenging flight tests, culminating in an intercept attempt, he said. The Missile Defense Agency says it is restructuring test program objectives to emphasize fundamentals. Meaning they're going to teach the crew to read? I hope so, because that really is so fundamental. And ladies and gentlemen, for further reassurance, we turn to this. The U.S. Army says January 18th of this year, it has raised its maximum enlistment age, not retirement age, the age to get into the Army, from 35 to 40 years old. You can be a 40-year-old guy, 40-year-old private. How about that? Isn't that cool? Daddy, where are you going?
I'm joining the Army. I'm going to be a buck private.
The measures are the latest in a series of steps the Army has taken over the past year to offset a slump in recruiting. The Army failed to hit its recruiting goal of 80,000 new recruits in fiscal 2005. Recruiting figures have since improved, but the war in Iraq has made it difficult to meet the demand for fresh soldiers. Wonder why that would be. Army Secretary Francis Harvey denied charges that the Army is a broken force, telling reporters it has met its recruiting goals in the last 7 months with the help of bonuses. But he acknowledged that recruiting remains, quote, a month-to-month thing. That's the way the Secretary of the Army talks now. A month-to-month thing. End quote. One more quote. As I said, the rest of the year looks promising, but we're certainly not going to sit on our laurels, unquote. Well, don't sit on those laurels. The laurels that include not meeting your goals and having to raise the enlistment age to 40? No, I wouldn't sit on those. I'd find leafier laurels to sit on, me personally, for the comfort, you know, just for the ease. Quote, experience has shown that older recruits who can meet the physical demands of military service generally make excellent soldiers based on their maturity, motivation, loyalty, and patriotism. But what about their lack of testosterone-fueled craziness? Doesn't that count for anything? Okay. Guess not. Ladies and gentlemen, some news about Iraq while we're at it. Some of this may have been inside the bubble, some of it not. A fundamental change, this is from the Washington Post, a fundamental change overtaking the Army. A new focus devoted to, in the Army classrooms. Counterinsurgency. Remember last week I was talking about the questionable assessment of humans as a learning species? The Army is now beginning to teach counterinsurgency tactics. How long has it been since the Vietnam War? Exactly. Officers studying at the Army's Command and General Staff College in Fort Leavenworth are flocking to elective courses on the subject,
Well, why make it mandatory? We're only in two counterinsurgency struggles at the moment.
Soon the Army will require a block of instruction, I see, in counterinsurgency for all the 1,000 or so majors who attend the college each year. It is a survival thing for us, says Major Scott Sansala. This year he is taking courses on counterinsurgency, terrorism strategy, intelligence, and defeating roadside bombs, because he's going to go to Iraq. The air of hubris that some Army officers displayed just a few years ago has dissipated, replaced by a sense they have a lot to learn about how to operate effectively in Iraq and about the cultures and languages there and in other likely hotspots. So we've spent, that one estimate a couple weeks ago estimated $2 trillion to teach the Army how to fight the war that they've been in for 3 years? That is money so well spent. It's a vastly different Army from 2003, says Larry DeRita, who was the Pentagon spokesman until recently. What we're trying to do is change the culture, to modify that culture, that solving the problem isn't just a tactical problem of guns and bombs and maneuvers, says Army Colonel Clinton J. Anker, director of the Doctrine Writing Office that defines how the Army does what it does. The Army and the Marines are collaborating on the new manual on insurgency, an interim manual which, according to the Washington Post, some insiders see as a mediocre stopgap. The Army largely walked away from counterinsurgency after the Vietnam War. The subject was not mentioned in the mid-1970s version of the Army's key fighting manual, you see. So, have to fight two more before they start training for it, don't you know? Terrorism and instability has brought Iraq's oil industry to a standstill, according to the Gulf Daily News of Bahrain, the newspaper that Michael Jackson wakes up to each morning. If, in fact, the result is starvation of investment in technology, the same problem the oil industry in Iraq has suffered for 35 years, says oil industry public relations manager Mohammed Ali Mustafa. Quote, Iraq has been isolated from the rest of the world for all this time, especially since the start of the Iran-Iraq war. But terrorism has meant we are not getting the foreign investment that we desperately need to get back on our feet. In all this time, not a single major oil industry-related contract has been awarded and no joint venture projects announced.
Hey, that's good progress.
Mustafa cited Iraq's biggest oil refinery in Beji having to shut down production for 2 weeks because of terrorist threats. The threats were as a result of Iraq raising oil prices. The terrorists had become used to buying oil very cheaply and then smuggling it out of the country and selling it for hefty margins, he said. He added, quote, there is no doubt the U.S. toppled the former regime for its own interests. This is the Iraq oil ministry's PR guy saying this. But, quote, he continues, we are in need of foreign expertise and investment as well, so the benefits are reciprocal. The Iraqi people are better off now, he adds, possibly because he wants to keep his job. The war on terrorism and civil conflicts in Africa have intensified the threat of persecution and even genocide of minorities around the world, according to a new report. According to a study by the London-based minority rights group International, minority groups in Iraq and Sudan are most at risk.
It's good progress.
Ethnic groups in Somalia, Afghanistan, and Myanmar also made the top five of minorities under threat. Other countries included in the top 15 of states where minorities are most threatened included Indonesia, number 10.
Coming in at number 10, Indonesia.
Russia, number 14, and the Philippines, number 15. The Coalition of the Wilting. The Italian government, facing an uphill electoral campaign, this week detailed plans to end its unpopular involvement in Iraq by withdrawing about half its forces by June and the rest by year's end. The Coalition of the Ceremonial, the British Army has announced that a unit it was originally scheduled to send to Iraq will be retained in London for duties at Buckingham Palace. And the U.S. Agency for International Development paints a dire and detailed picture of the Iraq security situation in its request for contractors to bid on its $1.5 billion 28-month project to help stabilize 10 major Iraqi cities. To prepare potential bidders for their task, USAID included a little briefing with the contractor application, which describes Iraq as being in the midst of an insurgency whose tactics, quote, include creating chaos in Iraq society as a whole and fomenting civil war, unquote. Many of the attacks are against coalition and Iraqi security forces, the paper says, and they, quote, significantly damage the country's infrastructure and cause a tide of adverse economic and social effects that ripple across Iraq, unquote.
It's good progress.
It is increasingly common for tribesmen to turn in to the authorities' enemies as insurgents. This is a form of tribal revenge, the paper says. So that would be why the civil war prospects are increasing. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I've noticed that even my conservative friends say they don't listen to Rush Limbaugh anymore. The fact that sometimes I believe you can tell more by listening to promotional announcements than the actual program, because the promos really are like movie trailers. It's the best. It's the cream. Why bother with the rest of the milk? So here is a promotional announcement produced by one of the radio stations that carries the Rush Limbaugh program. Obviously, they thought this was a dynamite sample of Mr. Limbaugh's persuasive techniques.
We're dealing with Iraq our way, the conservative way, the American way, and the rest of the world is dealing with Iran its way. As appeasers, negotiators, the State Department way, the Kerry way, the Democratic Party way, the liberal way. I ask you, which nation is closer to becoming a nuclear threat and a genuine threat to the world, Iraq or Iran?
And I ask you, which was ever a threat, Iraq or Iran? That is, if that isn't the most fatuous skein of rhetoric ever unspooled on the radio airwaves, ladies and gentlemen, I'll eat my microphone. We attacked a country that didn't have a nuclear program and are in the position now of having to probably use diplomacy with a country, well, with two. How about North Korea, Rush, while you're at it, that do have nuclear programs? I got to start listening to him more. You know, not just the promos.
I've been too long with my nose in a book. I hope you sing just as good as you look. Come on over, baby, I got a song for you. A little jump or something I call the wintertime blues. Wow. suicide prevention group is all run away. I'm running out of groceries, I ain't got no rubber shoes. Bring the bacon, baby, I've got a wintertime blue. I could cut a hole in the floor, catch you a fish by a quarter to four. But I'm stuck up on this mountain, why? I'm a shooting to kill. Come on over, baby, I stand the cue. There's a man going crazy up here with the wintertime blues.
This is Le Show, and ladies and gentlemen, the battle is joined on the issue of the practice in the Bush administration of NSA, National Security Agency, spying, eavesdropping, whatever you want to call it, data mining, without the use of warrants, which some, including the Congressional Research Service, supposedly nonpartisan, says violates the law, because there's a law set up to say, well, you go to court and get a warrant, and then you can do that. And the Bush administration said, well, we, you know, this is a new kind of war. So the attacks proliferated for a while against it, including this week. Al Gore saying it was illegal, pretty much saying that flat out, as if he were running for something. No, I'm sorry. When he ran for something, he never said it flat out. But there was a drumbeat of opposition growing, so the administration is now responding. There will be speeches this week by Alberto Gonzalez. Can I have VO5 of Alberto, please? Just cue that up, just in case I need it. And a couple other administration bigwigs. And this past Friday, a briefing, top-secret briefing. Now, the briefings have been controversial themselves because the administration says they've briefed members of Congress, the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee in the House, Jane Harman, says, well, the law says you have to brief the whole Intelligence Committee. The administration has just been briefing the head Dem and the head Republican on each Intelligence Committee. So, as I say, Dick Cheney went to the White House this week. Guess he didn't need to ask if he could get in, to brief some selected Congress people on the program in the wake of all the criticism. Cheney, of course, a big supporter of the program. And try as you might, you won't find a lot of details about that briefing anywhere but underground.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of the man who's just a heartbeat away from history. Dick Cheney. Confidential.
Confidential.
Confidential. Washington's a pretty simple town once you've figured out the geography. A Frenchman laid it out fancier than a debutante's bustle, with diagonal streets radiating out from centers. But it's a lot simpler than that. One end of Pennsylvania Avenue is the talking end. That's where you find the building with the dome. The other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, where I hang my pacemaker, is the doing end. Every once in a while, the talkers get a little envious of the doers. So my account this week was Operation Less Talking, More Doing. I was feeling a little logy Friday morning. I think one of the Navy chefs in the secure undisclosed kitchen slipped a little butter into my tofu omelet. Well, this got me so full of tofu, I'm about to start crapping soybeans. It's gotten so the only thing resembling red meat that I get close to is the stuff coming out of my mouth. My constituent in chief was up to his eyeballs in State of the Union prep. There's a big healthcare hunk in the draft, and the president was suggesting that instead of the normal business suit, he deliver the speech in a doctor's uniform. But fuller heads were prevailing. In any case, the job before me was to give some of the more malleable members of the speechifying class a little briefing on the NSA's warrantless spying program. In my personal playbook, of course, warrants are like tonsils. They're nice to have, but you don't really need them. Of course, that's a little too clear-cut to appeal to our distinguished legislators. Don't get me wrong, I was one of them once. Then I grew up. Anyway, I was waiting for them as they trooped into the Situation Room. Good place to do the job. The data flow is impressive, if not intimidating. And some of my bill-writing friends probably thought they might run into Wolf Blitzer. Friday, 10:15 a.m. All right, folks, the sooner we start the briefing, the sooner you'll be thoroughly briefed.
Mr. Vice President, speaking for my fellow senators as well as for the gentleman and gentle lady from the other house, I just want to...
I'm sure you're going to eventually say you're grateful for the opportunity, Joe. But we don't have all the oxygen in the world down here.
Gotcha.
But, Senator Lieberman, I might as well start by briefing you.
All right. I don't want my colleagues to...
They'll get their turn. You're from Connecticut, correct me if I'm wrong, but the big industry there is insurance.
Oh, we're proud to number a large number of the members of the insurance community among our...
Lots of folks unhappy with the insurance industry right about now. Folks on the Gulf Coast, I hear, mighty upset. Be ashamed to have some embarrassing hearings on that subject, wouldn't it, Joe?
Well, we'd just have to let the chips fall
where we dropped them. Gee, I hate to think about increasing the regulatory burden on that valuable and important industry, Joe, but to tell you the truth, I hate even more to think about you lending your name to the scurrilous attack on a fine espionage program.
Oh, Dick, you're reading my mind without a warrant. You don't have to tell me all this. I'm just here because my nephew asked me to get him one of the Situation Room souvenir pins. He's kind of a collector-type nut.
Miss Pelosi, always nice to see the other gender represented.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President, but I think we'd all like to spend as much of this valuable time as possible getting down to substance.
Ooh. Kitty still has her claws.
Mr. Vice...
Save your umbrage for the folks in the cheap seats. I know you've got to stick up your pretty little hiney in this warrant business, but here's what's been monopolizing my bedtime reading lately.
And just what are these?
Oh, I'm sure you recognize your Yahoo searches for vibrating nipple clamps, Mrs. Pelosi.
Give me those.
Sure. We got plenty more where they came from. And we do tend to think the Google searches might be even more enlightening when they come on stream. Enough substance for you.
This is silly. Stop playing games with the American people.
Nancy, can I call you Nancy? There's an old Kenny Rogers song that says, "No one to hold 'em, no one to fold 'em." That's the only game we're playing. We're holding, you're folding.
Mr. Vice President, do you think you could spare a briefing for a member of your own party?
Senator Specter, I was getting to you.
Because although I have great respect for my colleagues at the Intelligence Committee, I remain deeply convinced that this matter should be heard before the...
Before the committee you're the chairman of. No, I grasp the concept. It's called Get Your Face on Television Now That Your Hair Has Grown Back, and it's a good concept.
Well, Mr. Vice President, I would be in favor of the Judiciary Committee looking into this matter, even if I were only the ranking member.
You know, Arlen, I read a little history. It's just a way of keeping my mental knuckles sharpened. But last time the executive branch had both balls strapped on, there was a guy over here who did data mining before the term was even invented. A certain Mr. Hoover.
Mm-hmm. His name is on the FBI building, for now.
Interesting things you can learn about certain words spoken in certain phone calls to certain overseas locations by certain senators.
Mr. Vice President, I don't know what you're trying to imply, but my life is an open book.
Or certain senators, staff members.
One of my aides is from Azerbaijan, but that shouldn't...
Senator, do you know where I live?
It's secure and undisclosed.
I'll give you one clue. It's not in the land of should.
And Mr. Vice President, Chairman of the Intel Committees, I and Representative Hoekstra probably should get some kind of briefing, shouldn't we?
Well, Senator Roberts, Mr. Hoekstra, is fine members of the President's party who clearly share the desire to see the executive branch not be hamstrung in a time of perpetual war. I don't think you need it. But if you feel like it, gentlemen, you can go brief yourselves. Naturally, I wanted to stick around and trade small talk with our elected representatives, but they had television cameras to find. Besides, I had a lunch date with a tofu loaf. End of partial diary for mid-January 2006. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney. Confident.
Why I ramble, and you want to know why I roam. You've been wondering why I run around and ain't never had a home. My daddy was a gambler, he rambled all over this land. I'm just a chip off the same old block. I'm a natural born gambling man. I'm a natural born gambling man. Yeah, natural born gambling man. I can throw a seven and follow with the left. I'm a natural born gambling man. I rambled off down to Memphis, and then I met old One-Eyed Sam. He said, come here, son, let me you have a little game. So I throwed my money down. He snuck a one off of the bottom, and Buddy seen him when he got his hand. I pulled my pistol and I mowed him down. I'm a natural-born gambling man. I'm a natural-born gambling man. A natural-born gambling man. I can throw a seven and follow with it. I'm a natural-born gambling man. Uh-huh. They haul me off to Nashville, of course, and lock me in a dirty old cell. But they give me a number for my name. 'Twas a number that I love so well. It is 3 7s and 11. That's a good hand. I knowed right then that I'd won again, for I'm a natural born gambling man. On the day that I got my pardon, the warden, he says to me,
son, why don't you take some good advice and let that old gambling be?
I says, now you look here, Mr. Warden. Let me and you just play one hand. And I'll bet you 10 that you can't win. For I'm a natural-born gambling man. I'm a natural-born gambling man. Yeah, natural-born gambling man. Old Jody picked the cotton in the forks of the branch. I'm a natural-born gambling man.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Dateline Knoxville, Tennessee. A Knoxville City Council member has apologized on behalf of the city to its fire chief for a racially insensitive remark. Chief Carlos Perez filed a formal complaint earlier this month saying one departmental employee called him Pedro in a derogatory manner. After learning of the incident, City Councilman Steve Hall apologized on the city's behalf at last week's council meeting. Hall said local government can't tolerate such behavior from its employees, regardless of which minority the statements belittle. Speaking of minorities, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid this week apologized to 33 Republican senators singled out for ethics criticism in a report from his office entitled, quote, Republican Abuse of Power, unquote. The document released by my office yesterday went too far, and I want to convey to you my personal regrets, Reid said in a letter. I'm writing to apologize for the tone of this document and the decision to single out individual senators for criticism in it. Reid came under attack over the report, which was issued by his staff on Senate letterhead, researching, compiling, and distributing what amounts to nothing more than a campaign ad on the taxpayer's dime raises serious ethical questions, said Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn. Dateline Baton Rouge, Entergy, that's the electric utility in southern Louisiana, Entergy CEO Wayne Leonard apologized to the five-member Louisiana Public Service Commission this week for previous statements that indicated the company had three votes in favor of rate hikes to cover hurricane damage. Leonard said the media misinterpreted his comments to a November conference of utility investors to say he believed he controlled the three commissioners. Quote, I clearly and regrettably misspoke, Leonard said, adding that he is, quote, sorry these words have been misinterpreted, unquote. He pointed to a chart of the exact quote, quote, Louisiana, comma, I think, comma, you know, comma, we've got three very solid votes there. Leonard said the media reported his having said, we've got three very solid votes there. Yeah, it's the damn media leaving out the commas and the you knows. Dateline Tallinn, Estonia. Estonian President Arnold Rüütel said he was shocked to find out that his underage granddaughters were throwing parties in the presidential palace in his absence. Quote, I am deeply concerned and I apologize once again for the incidents on behalf of my family. He's currently on a visit to the United States. When I delivered my New Year address to the nation, I expressed concerns over problems with youth, but I did not suspect that these problems could hit my own family so hard, he added. Dateline Tehran, Iran on Tuesday lifted a ban it had imposed on CNN a day earlier for misquoting President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad ordered the reversal due to the expression of an apology from CNN, according to state-run Iranian television. CNN was cited for mistakes in its translation of a speech by Ahmadinejad defending Iran's right to conduct nuclear research. CNN acknowledged the error in its U.S. broadcast and said it had apologized. CNN had originally quoted the president as saying Iran had the right to build nuclear weapons. The network acknowledged, in fact, he said that Iran has the right to develop nuclear energy, unquote. Anderson Cooper was not available for comment, but reportedly felt bad. And, of course, Mayor Ray Nagin of New Orleans apologized for a Martin Luther King Day speech in which he predicted New Orleans would be a chocolate city. I said some things that were totally inappropriate. It shouldn't have happened, Nagin said, explaining he was caught up in the moment. That damn moment. It'll get you every time. Nagin also said his comments about God were inappropriate and stemmed from a private conversation he'd had with a minister earlier. I need to be more sensitive and more aware of what I'm saying, he said. Anderson Cooper felt bad about that, too. Dateline said, oh, this is not an apology. It's just a great, great, wonderful quote. The last apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, the Liberal Democrat Party in Britain, in shock from its leader's forced resignation over alcoholism, are plunged into a political nightmare when one of their rising stars and a contender for the leadership of the party, Mark Oughton, was forced to admit a lengthy affair with a, and this is British usage here, rent boy. He immediately resigned as his party's home affairs spokesman. He began a round of public apologies to his family, friends, and political colleagues, and he apologized for the embarrassment to his party caused by his affair with a 23-year-old rent boy. His first apology went to his wife, Linda, and their two daughters. That's nice. Apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. And my favorite quote of the week comes from San Quentin, California, as Clarence Ray Allen shuffled from his wheelchair to a gurney inside the death chamber a day after his 76th birthday. Allen had suffered a heart attack back in September, and had asked prison authorities to let him die if he went into cardiac arrest before his scheduled execution, a request that prison officials said they would not honor. According to prison spokesman Vernell Crittenden, "At no point are we not going to value the sanctity of life. We would resuscitate him, then execute him," unquote. That's the culture of life we know and love. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, available as channel 136 and Sirius satellite radio, a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow, available around the world at two different locations on your computer whenever you want it, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it would be just like being even more available if you'd agree to join with me then, wouldn't you? All righty. Thank you very much. Email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. Le Show playlist available at harryshearer.com. You can go to harryshearer.com also to get on the mailing list for a very occasional and incredibly low-impact newsletter email blast for your viewing pleasure. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the possibly mean, but nonetheless hospitable home of the homeless.